This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was our 32nd president, and on his inauguration day, in the darkest days of the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt set out a timeless challenge to Americans.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
That was a challenge that FDR was forced to learn in a most personal way as he overcame polio, which left him paralyzed in 1921. What was unquestionably a personal tragedy became a force that helped shape Franklin Roosevelt into a leader who guided the nation through the Depression and through World War II. That transformation is the subject of a new book from Michigan-born historian James Tobin. Its title, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. Welcome back to Stateside, Jim. Very good to have you with us.
Thanks, Cindy. Good to be here.
You know, for most of us who grew up post-Salk vaccine, and I'm one of them, I remember us going to the school and being given the sugar cube and being very relieved that it wasn't a shot that we were getting as
Me
a little
too.
Child. You were
Me
afraid
too.
You were going to get a needle. It is a different world for all of us today than America in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. That fear of polio was so pervasive, wasn't it?
Right. And it really polio became worse and worse in the years after FDR became sick. So that really the peak of the epidemics were in the 40s and 50s. So when we were kids, that was when the fear of polio was the highest.
And actually, as you point out in your book, it was improvements in hygiene and cleanliness that actually led to this. How was that?
Yeah, it's a strange deal. Yeah. But the polio virus is endemic in the human environment. That means it's everywhere.
Okay.
But the thing is that when little kids would catch the virus as infants, maternal antibodies in their own immune systems would fight it off, and then they would have lifelong immunity. As sanitation improved, and it's passed through human waste, but as sanitation improved, fewer and fewer and fewer kids were exposed to it at that very young age. And so if you weren't exposed to it and then you got the virus later on, you were more likely to become sick. And that's why the age of infection also became older.
So it's a public health improvement came at a price.
Yeah. Unintended consequences,
Mm-mm-mm.
Classic case.
So take us to August 1921 and tell us, how did FDR actually contract polio?
Well, we can't speak with 100% certainty. But if you look at the timing, it becomes very clear with perhaps 98% certainty that FDR caught the virus at a Boy Scout campout on July 28th of that summer, 1921. He was chair of the New York area Boy Scouts mm-hmm. and went up to a state park on the Hudson River. And then 10 days later, 12 days later, he began to experience symptoms. That's the incubation period for polio. So he almost surely got it by one of two ways, either from a Boy Scout who was carrying the virus, perhaps without being sick himself, mm-hmm. or from polluted water at that state park. And I was able to find public health documents that showed that the waters there at that state park were tainted.
And then that incubation period passes. And what, it just started with little aches and pains?
It started with flu-like symptoms.
Okay.
Yes, aches and pains in his back, and he began to run a fever.
Okay.
It took another day or two for him to experience any weakness and then finally paralysis.
Well, it is stunning to read your book and see how quickly this disease progresses and the polio took over his body, starting with those chills. Would you read an excerpt for us?
I will. This is just after he had had the first experience of symptoms, August 10th, 1921. Colonies of the polio virus were now creeping upward through the spinal cord. The ensuing war between these viral invaders and the body's immunological defenders resulted in severe inflammation inside the spinal cord. The roaring inflammation, in turn, aroused the sensory nerve cells. For Roosevelt, the result was shooting, shocking pain in every one of the affected muscles. Adult patients have compared the sensation to having nails hammered into one's flesh or to having one's teeth drilled without an anesthetic. Hallucinations and nightmares are not uncommon. During the afternoon of August 11th, FDR leaned forward, began to stand up, and then stopped. His right knee now seemed too weak to support his weight on that side. He lay back down. By evening, he was feeling the same weakness in his left knee. When he awoke the next morning, Friday, both legs felt rubbery and flimsy. It wasn't that he had lost sensation. He could feel the fabric of his pajamas against his skin, and when he put his hands on his knees, he could feel his hands. But when he willed his legs to move, they were listless. Rays of pain spread through his back and legs and feet. As the hours of Friday passed, more muscles seemed dormant. He couldn't tighten his buttocks or clench the muscles of his gut. By evening, he realized he could not hold a pencil. There was something the matter with his thumbs. By the time he tried to go to sleep that night, he was unable to stand up at all.
Historian Jim Tobin reading from his new book, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. Now, I've seen it written that for the rest of his life, FDR refused to accept that he was permanently paralyzed. Is that true, or was there more of a dimensional aspect to that?
Well, he certainly refused to accept the idea that he would never be able to walk without assistance. He continued, I think – well, this is a complicated story.
Yes,
Let me try and step us through it. I think that for a couple of years he thought that he could recover the ability to walk without any braces, without crutches, without canes. Then at a certain point, about 4 or 5 years into his situation, I think he gave up that idea. But he continued to believe that he could regain strength in his muscles and his legs, and he would be able to get around with braces, canes, crutches. In other words, he'd be able to walk even though it was with assistance. When he was elected governor of New York in 1928, he had to make a choice between pursuing his recovery more fully, giving more time to it, or becoming governor, running for governor. And if he were elected, then he wouldn't have that kind of time to spend. So I think at that point he realized, this is about as far as I'm going to go. So in a way, he sacrificed the hope of further recovery for the hope of gaining the presidency.
How did he plunge into rehabilitation? He had been such a virile, vibrant, active, physical guy. How did he wrap his arms around rehabilitation?
Well, at first the effort was to build up his upper body. And if you just look at photographs, before and after photos from the polio years, the early polio years, you see at first a kind of slender, svelte guy, well-built but not bulked up. Then if you look at 1924, 1925, especially if you see pictures of him in a bathing suit, you realize his shoulders, his chest have grown. That was all the result of exercise with his upper body. He also began to exercise his legs as soon as he could. And when he discovered the mineral pools at Warm Springs, Georgia, he found the ideal environment for that kind of exercise. He also began to work increasingly with physical therapists who helped him a great deal to do the right kind of exercise to regain the kind of mobility that was still within his reach. So it was a process of years and years of working on this.
And Warm Springs, of course, was a part of his life until he – did he not die in Warm Springs?
He did. He did die at Warm Springs in 1945.
I'm speaking with Jim Tobin, historian, who is the author of the book The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. I'm kind of interested in you explore his relationship with his wife, Eleanor, which had already been badly damaged earlier in their marriage after he had an affair with her personal secretary, Lucy Mercer. Tell us how the polio affected their relationship.
Well, the marriage was under a great deal of strain before he developed this condition. When he got sick, she absolutely came to his side and helped him in every way that she could. Eleanor had had training as a nurse, so she knew how to be literally a nurse to him, and she did so for many months, really. When he began to pursue his recovery in other places, first by taking long houseboat trips in the Florida Keys and then at Warm Springs, she increasingly sort of sent him off to do that on his own. And she began to pursue her own career in politics. I think that the polio episode meant a kind of further evolution in their marriage where he was going off on his track and she was able to go off on her track. And so they were mutually supportive, still with deep bonds of history and affection between them. Mm. but not the kind of intimate marriage that one associates with their very earliest years. And that was the pattern that continued right into the White House.
And you absolutely have to feel for her, and you take us kind of where she is at, kind of trapped between a husband who needed her because of this illness, children, growing children, and a kind of a gorgon of a mother-in-law in Sarah Roosevelt wanted it her way and couldn't understand the choices that Franklin was making.
No. I mean, Franklin was really in the driver's seat there. Traditionally, the sort of lore of the Roosevelts in this period is that there was a battle between Eleanor and Franklin's mother over his future. But that misunderstands Franklin's own self-determination. In that family, he made the decisions about what he was going to do. And it's true that his mother resisted his decision to go back into politics, but he had no interest in her views about that matter.
And he did. He eventually went back. He was elected governor of New York in 1929, and then he becomes president. And you feel this really – the man he became as came through this polio experience.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I began to realize was that polio was really central – to the story that he had to tell as he ran for office, making this comeback. You know, before he had been the prototypical man born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And although he had a great name, he had a great presence in politics, it was really the story that he was able to develop as somebody who had been knocked down and come back
and from had suffered.
That, and had suffered deeply. I think that's what allowed people to now see him as a really sympathetic character who – especially once the Depression was underway, somebody who could sympathize with their situation. And that made him all the more appealing a candidate. And people of course, knew that he had been crippled, again, contrary to the conventional wisdom nowadays.
Yes, we seem to think that it had been kind of masked from the public, although they didn't – as you point out, no one saw him in a wheelchair very much.
Well, FDR wasn't seen in a wheelchair because he never came out in public in a wheelchair. And so there are only three photographs of him in a chair.
And that was a conscious decision because –
Well, there are a couple of things. FDR did not want – well, for one thing, FDR wasn't in a wheelchair even indoors very much. And movies of FDR have sort of misportrayed this. FDR used a wheelchair only for fleeting moments in the course of a day to get from one room to another. Once he was in the room where he was going, he switched into an office chair or a comfortable chair. So the wheelchair is not the constant presence in his life that people assume. When he was outdoors, when he was in public, if he wanted to approach a speaker's stand, he wanted to be seen standing and walking, as he could do with assistance. A wheelchair was a symbol of invalidism, of poor health. FDR was not in poor health. He just couldn't walk by himself. So the wheelchair, I think, would have sent an absolutely wrong message to the one he had to convey to the public.
And interestingly, that was the one chosen for the statue in Washington.
Yeah, it was chosen for the statue. There's a great statue in London that shows a different FDR. He's standing with a cane. That's the image that FDR was happy to portray. So, I mean, I understand why disability advocates wanted to see him in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. It's not that that doesn't make some sense.
Sure.
But I like the one in London better.
I loved your line that conventional wisdom is that FDR became president in spite of polio. I think the evidence suggests that he became president because of polio.
I do. Yeah. It has to do with that narrative that he was able to develop. Mm-hmm. And polio, in practical terms, also kept him on the political sidelines during the middle 1920s. Which was a time when the Democratic Party was tearing itself to pieces between the so-called wets and the so-called dries, a fight over prohibition, also over religion, over the rise of immigrants in the cities. FDR was able to be at the edge of that battle and come back only when the time was really propitious for him to come back.
He wasn't down in the mud during the 1920s.
Right.
So in a sense, then he was able to come through with that.
Right.
We have that image of him and certainly bolstered by photos and what newsreel might have existed, the chipper smile, the demeanor that is upbeat, the upturned chin and the jaunty cigarette holder. And yet you write that he remarked to Orson Welles, you and I are the two best actors in America. Was there a different life for him away from the crowds and the press and the photographers?
Well, no. I think the jaunty FDR that we have in our mm-hmm. popular consciousness, that's the same FDR, very much so, that people knew in private. So when FDR made that reference to acting, I think it's a blended message. He's talking to some extent about his ability to manipulate people one-on-one by shows of temper or by shows of jocularity. FDR put on the mood and the temperament that he needed in the practice of politics. But it's also partly about polio. To show himself to be – I see this as a paradox. Yeah. I think he had to convince himself – convince people, convince the public that he was the man that he really was when they assumed, when they attached a stigma to him, when they attached – when they put a mask on him of
invalid.
Disability.
Yes.
Invalid.
Yes.
That's right. He had to show them, no. I am a man of strength and health. But that in a way was also a performance.
Interesting. You quoted his aide, Harry Hopkins, the guy never knows when he's licked. So it's no surprise that FDR went for that fourth term in the White House, but you seem to feel he shouldn't have.
He shouldn't have. FDR by that time was ill
with
hypertension, heart disease. Mm-hmm. He had no business running for president in 1944. I think that he dealt with heart disease in the same way he dealt with polio in his own mind, which is, I'm just going to get past this. I defeated polio. I'm going to defeat this. But these are two obviously very different diseases.
What most surprised you as you researched this book and learned more about Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Well, I suppose it was the fact that from the very beginning after he contracted polio that he never let down that optimistic approach. I was going to say facade, but it wasn't just a facade. Mm. I think he insisted on that approach in his own mind. This was going to be all right. He was not going to let this defeat him. Now, that is not, I learned, an atypical response to trauma and severe loss. That's how many people respond in this sort of situation. You know, and it works. I talked to a terrific physical medicine specialist at the University of Michigan, James Richardson. And when I asked him about denial as a way of coping with this kind of traumatic illness, he shrugged his shoulders and he said, "What's wrong with that?" He said, "For a lot of people, that works." And it certainly worked for FDR.
It's a wonderful book, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency, by Michigan-born historian James Tobin. Always a pleasure to talk with you on Stateside. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. Thanks for having me.